Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 119, Out There. Being born on a planet, we tend to think that we can go anywhere in the universe if we just pack an overnight bag. And we tend to think that everywhere in the universe will have 1g of gravity. Alas, neither of these things are true, and this does raise the question of whether us, or anyone else, will ever really leave home. Dear Cheap Astronomy, are we ever likely to undertake interstellar trade? As regular listeners would be aware, here at Cheap Astronomy, we think faster-than-light travel just ain't gonna happen. That limits your interstellar trade options a good deal, where our potential alien trading partners may be anything up to 100 light-years away. There are over 500 G-type stars, that is, sun-like stars, that are within a 100 light-year radius from us. That includes some old science fiction favourites, like Tau Ceti and 82 Eridani, which are just 10 to 20 light-years away. But that's still 10 to 20 years travel time, assuming that you can get near the speed of light, which is also kind of unlikely, since collisions with dust grains, let alone anything bigger, will at least slow you down, if not destroy, your starship. So if there is to be interstellar trade, it's most likely to be managed by long-haul robot transportation, since no human or alien is going to want to fritter their life away to hand-deliver, or tentacle-deliver, what someone purchased on ET Bay. And in any case, what would you purchase from an alien? And equally, what would they purchase from us? Here we need to forget about Star Trek aliens, who look like humans with lumpy bits on their forehead. In reality, it's very unlikely our physiologies would be close enough to allow you to drink Romulan ale, let alone enjoy it, or get intoxicated by it. So, forget food and drink. We might trade artifacts, like trinkets and shiny beads, just because they are alien and have a certain novelty value. But more functional items like furniture, or clothing, or sunglasses aren't likely to be mutually compatible. You could just exchange the raw materials, like exotic alien timbers or fabrics, but even then the transport cost overheads would be astronomical. Small astronomy joke there. So another option is to forget the whole transport part and just exchange information. After all, that can be moved at the speed of light. General information about each other's local environment would be interesting, as would each other's perspectives on the wider universe. So, for example, we might exchange James Webb telescope pictures for whatever they've got. We could also swap engineering tips on rocket engines or particle accelerators or even refrigerators. However, the closer you get to mundane items, like flat-screen TVs, the more likely differences in physiology, gravity, and atmosphere will make things of no interest to the other party. Flat-screen TVs are unlikely to be of interest to aliens, unless they have forward-facing eyes that perceive light within our visual range, and even if they did, they probably couldn't make any sense of our movies. But perhaps we could sell them natural history documentaries with some kind of subtitling they could understand. What might work even better is 3D printing. If there is an existing interstellar trade network, you'd think that's what it would be based on. There'd be some kind of standard universal printing machine, the schematics of which could be downloaded, and once you've built yourself a printer, you can then select from a catalogue of items, recipes really, which would list the elemental ingredients you would need to load up at your end, and then the printer would follow the recipe to assemble those ingredients into whatever physical object you'd chosen from the catalogue. Of course, there'd be an expectation that we would contribute things to the catalogue too. Indeed, that might be the basis of any trade transaction. You have to contribute a recipe for something that aliens want, and thereby earn credits so that you can access recipes for the things that you want. To kick all this off, we have to start broadcasting our presence, either at specific candidate stars, or just broadly across a 360 sweep of the sky, so that we can establish communications. To do that, we first have to get over our illogical fear of not drawing attention to ourselves. We really don't have a lot to fear, since our natural resources are ubiquitous across the universe, our planet is unlikely to be readily habitable, we're extremely unlikely to be edible, and anyone who can currently cross interstellar distances is not going to be interested in stealing our comparatively primitive technology. It's time to start a conversation, and given it's going to take decades or centuries to get an answer, we might as well start now.
This is the middle bit.
Of course, there is tremendous endeavour and challenge in sending people to the Moon and to Mars, but at the end of the day, all we're really doing is exploring the neighbourhood. Interstellar travel in person doesn't seem all that likely or necessary. And to even explore the neighbourhood, there are significant challenges we're yet to overcome. For example, Dear Cheap Astronomy, why aren't we doing more with artificial gravity? Good question. As we previously discussed on this podcast, and as others have discussed on pretty much every space-related podcast, zero gravity, okay, microgravity, is really bad for you. Your bones dissolve, your muscles wither, your cardiovascular system is deconditioned, your eye geometry changes, and if that's not bad enough, your face gets all puffy as well. We've pushed out microgravity exposure time to a year or more, and people do recover, but if it's going to take a year or more to get to Mars, our first Martian astronauts are going to take that one small step and then collapse in a heap. Regular listeners will be aware that here at Cheap Astronomy, we think the idea of humans landing on Mars in the 2030s is laughable, and the lack of an effective artificial gravity solution is one of the reasons that we're laughing. Along with the lack of an effective landing and relaunch solution, or a radiation protection solution, or a mental health solution, and that's just for starters. But hey, let's drop all this negativity and flip the narrative. Living and working in microgravity is actually a good thing. If you've seen any of the visuals of the inside of the International Space Station, there's s*** everywhere. More specifically, there's s*** on every wall of a room. If you look at an equivalent workspace on Earth, nearly everything is on the floor and the ceiling is just dead space, and the HR team live in constant terror that anything attached to a wall could also detach and fall on someone. So, microgravity allows a crew to make maximal use of the cramped quarters of their spacecraft. Also, the risk of falling or dropping something on your foot is non-existent, and with a few well-placed handholds, you can move around quite fast and in all directions. So while you can rotate the ship to create artificial gravity, it means you'll be back to working on one surface again. Also, you can't just rotate any old spacecraft to create gravity. The radius of the spin has to be quite large, otherwise you get gravity at your feet but not at your head, so you might need to build a spinning wheel of around 100 metres in diameter, or otherwise you spin a cabin around on a 50-metre tether. Either way, there's some substantial engineering challenges involved, and if you're just spinning parts of your spacecraft, there will be a lot of frictional wear and tear at the axes of rotation, which is not an ideal scenario for a spacecraft on a long and lonely voyage with limited maintenance opportunities. The less moving parts you have to worry about, the better. So, in fact, there are some compelling arguments against rotating spacecraft to create artificial gravity. Star Trek notions of graviton emitters and uranium plating may just be geometrically unworkable, even when we do have such magical technologies at our disposal. A more practical, and indeed more likely, solution for a small spacecraft is to have human-sized centrifuges that crew members can hop into for a few hours a day while they watch a movie, read a book, or even sleep. They probably still need plenty of load-bearing aerobic exercise sessions to stay in optimal condition, but the centrifuge sessions should particularly help in reversing some of the fluid distribution problems. At least, that's the theory. We are yet to test whether such a solution really works in space, apart from doing one very brief and somewhat inconclusive test on STS-90, a space shuttle mission. It's possible that spending a few hours on a 5-meter diameter centrifuge, spinning at around 15 revolutions per minute, could be enough to shift your body fluids back to Earth normal, at least temporarily. It's unlikely this spinning will have much effect on bone and muscle degradation, since it would be equivalent to lying on a bed that had its foot tilted towards the floor. Admittedly, building such a solution comes with its own problems. For example, you'd need 2 counter-spinning centrifuges to avoid the surrounding spacecraft from being spun around. So that's a lot of mass, a lot of engineering, a lot of power, a lot of precious cabin space, and quite a lot of injury potential. But if it's managed well, the outcome would be healthy astronauts, so maybe it's worth looking into.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. Space is big, and it's unlikely we'll ever meet aliens, but we might well buy things off them. And as for just touring the neighbourhood, it's still early days for us. Just getting to Mars will require a technology leap we can't quite anticipate yet. We either need to get there a lot faster, or build bigger ships with spinning parts as well as better radiation shielding. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you just want to float a new idea past us, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll spin something up for you. Thanks for listening. Steve Nellick, Cheap Astronomy.